This is a HeadGum Podcast.
Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Byte Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's Byte.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hello, halflings! It's me, Jasper William Cartwright, and I am joined today by...
Jeremy Cobb, but Amy Meester from D&D Disability calls me Boss.
Boss. Just Boss.
Boss. Yeah.
Just Boss. Did she specify to say Boss in that kind of register as well?
Amy uses they, them pronouns, but I don't think that they did.
Ah, it was just that was a creative choice of yours to go for Boss.
It seems the most appropriate way to say it, as opposed to Boss.
Yeah, that doesn't quite work the same. I guess we should probably go ahead and introduce our guest for this week. Very, very excitingly, this week we are joined by the creative lead of Blackwater D&D, the mental health advisor for Jasper's Game Day, and a registered counselor in suicide prevention using D&D. What? That is right. Emma Carlson, how the hell are you? Thanks for coming on the show.
Oh my gosh, thank you for having me. I'm heckin' great. I'm super awesome. Yeah, yay. I'm so excited to be here. Thanks for having me, guys.
Full Prince vibe? Woof!
This makes them even more black!
Cake glitches and pitches.
And lands in the cusp of a teaspoon.
Oh, no!
On a nat 20.
No!
You think this is just a game?
That's disgusting and I love it.
Yeah. We're about to get into something real big now. No, do not be silly. Thank you so much for coming on. We will do a quick little notice at the top. Today we're going to be talking about dealing and handling death in D&D, and topics like death and suicide may come up as well. So if that feels like it might be triggering to you, then please feel free to skip over this episode. You can watch out for us next week. You can catch an earlier episode. You can go listen to some Blackwater D&D. You can do whatever you want. Just go and, you know, chill. It's totally fine if you want to sit this one out. That is just wanted to give that a little warning up there.
I'll give a suggestion. Because I don't think I did not realize this was on YouTube until literally this past week. Ooh. But you can go watch the video of me on Blackwater D&D, where we have like a 2.5 hour conversation about a bunch of different D&D topics.
Hey.
Go check that out.
Amazing,
and then go
yeah.
watch a bunch more Blackwater D&D.
Thanks, guys.
Do
yeah. Come watch my show.
Indeed. Go watch Emma's show. So, Emma, hello. Welcome to Three Black Halflings. Thanks so much for coming on. We always start with our guests in the same place, which is we like to ask, what is your origin story in TTRPGs? What was it? What was the moment that you realized, damn, this is it? This is it for me. I'm in it and I'm
wow.
not leaving.
Wow. So I came into RPGs a little bit later on in my life. Like my dad played a lot of D&D growing up and used to like regale me with stories. And I dabbled a little bit when I was younger, but really started getting into RPG. I think I was about 20. So I was about 26. So like 5 years ago. And I was in the middle of my graduate degree to be a counselor, a therapist. And I was procrastinating on my thesis. And a friend of mine was like, do you want to come play some Dungeons and Dragons? And my husband, Tim, who's the DM for Blackwater, we were like, yeah, we would love to come play. And I was like, and then we played a couple of sessions and I was like, oh, this is the best thing I've never discovered before. This is going to become my life now. Started playing that with my, like in a campaign run by a friend of mine, Adam, who's a cast member on Blackwater as well. And then from there, it was just like a trip, stumble. Oh my gosh, I am deep diving into everything about RPGs, whether it's D&D or a whole bunch of different ones. I love everything about RPGs. And then as I continued on in my training to become a therapist, and as I like graduated school, I was like, oh, how can I marry the two things that I love a lot, my work and RPGs? And then I've started, you know, I've done training and now I use RPGs in my practice to help, you know, young folks. Primarily, I work with teens and adolescents mostly to, you know, rediscover parts of themselves and have fun and learn how to play.
Wow.
By using RPGs in therapy. And I work, as Jasper mentioned, I work a lot with young folks who are at risk of suicide and other risky disorders or risky behaviors. So, yeah, it's an amazing population to work with. And I love what I do. And I love that I get to just do stuff with RPGs all the time.
Yes.
So it's great.
Absolutely. This is so wonderful. And I'm so, so glad we've been able to get you on the show, because I feel like we bang on about this all the time on this show, which is about how it's given us this ability. And I think it gives people the ability every single day. Just how TTRPGs in general are such an amazing way of rediscovering, like you said just then, rediscovering parts of yourself and just exploring things and themes that you just wouldn't really get to dig into in real life, because you don't really get to make those big decisions, you know, like earth changing, whatever it is, decisions, but it can feel so real and personal and important. And I think we've talked about it a fair few times, but just how wonderful a kind of gift that is that TTRPGs can give you. And I'm fascinated to hear about this, and just I guess like potentially a good place maybe for us to start would be just using TTRPGs in your practice. Was that something that kind of you bought? Was that something that maybe already exists in some form and you've taken it on? I'm just really, really fascinated about that, because I can absolutely understand how that works. And I think it sounds like such an amazing thing. I'd love to know how that morphed, and then how that kind of goes. Like, what kind of tools do you use?
Gosh, we could talk for hours about that. That could be its own episode all in its own. Anytime. But the beautiful thing is like that. So using, you know, we think about RPGs as a collaborative human experience. They're storytelling. It's, you know, I've always toted the fact that D&D can be therapeutic, but unless in a very specific situation or circumstance, it's not like capital T therapy. So, you know, I've done some training through Game to Grow, which is this amazing organization located in Washington. So they are really pioneers of using D&D specifically as a therapy tool. And I've had the like pleasure and honor to do trainings with them, as well as, you know, working in my own private practice. But it's essentially a form of group therapy. So it's a bunch of people getting together, you know, led by a therapist, which would be a traditional group therapy setting. But rather than using something like a group therapy process or, you know, CBT, DBT, or whatever the other types of therapy acronyms that you want to throw out there, you're just using D&D. So you're using D&D to challenge the players, to promote distress tolerance, to help them deal with frustration, help them manage behaviors, get in touch with emotions, learn empathy. Because those are all things we experience in D&D, and you're just doing it in a very intentional and purposeful manner.
Yeah.
So a lot of times you do, like, you'll have a session of D&D, which will last about an hour and a half is generally the good time for like the therapy component of the D&D. And then you do a debrief afterwards and you get to talk to your players as a therapeutic DM and ask them, you know, how was that for you? How was that for your character? You can kind of straddle the alibi and learn things about the player and teach them things and have them discover aspects of themselves through their character. It's a stunningly beautiful process. And I find that, you know, having that little bit when players have that little bit of distance, clients have that little bit of distance because they're, you know, acting out things through their character, it's really profound change.
Yeah.
Because a lot of times, you know, our characters are avatars of ourselves. So if my character's learning about something, so am I.
Yeah, that was such a, like, even just as you were saying it then, like the idea of just being that little bit removed, I can definitely understand how at times I found it so much easier to like get rid of learned behaviors playing D&D than like in normal. Like I can immediately switch out of like even just things like by the way I speak, the way I interact mm-hmm. with people, I can switch out of it so quickly yeah. when playing D&D, and maybe yeah giving you access into something that maybe you find hard to replicate in real life could be really kind of life-changing, kind of teach you you can have those things, you can enjoy all facets of yourself and all the bits that make you up, like you said, if it is that your character is a slightly enlarged part of yourself. That's always the way I like to think about it, is that all of my characters are inside me somewhere, but they
absolutely
kind of represent,
they live in there.
They're just a different little bit of me, and then I dial up to 100, you know. So
absolutely,
I love the idea that if someone would is struggling in any way, that they would be able to find a beautiful part of themselves and dial that up to 100 and experience that. Like it makes me feel quite emotional thinking about it. Like it's such a wonderful thing.
Well, it's even like, I think of, players who are sitting at social tables rather than therapeutic tables. You know, there are things that we work through as players. Like I think about myself, the current character that I play with Blackwater right now, Nepenthe, who's a grave cleric. I was a lonely kid growing up. I was like only child. There were no kids on my street my age. I didn't hang out with a lot of kids when I was growing up, had a hard time making friends. And playing Nepi, who also, was quite, cloistered. She was like a nun. She was like a kind of a sequestered nun in an order, and then now is out exploring the world. And so she was lonely growing up. So I got to work through a lot of my lonely kid stuff through my character. And that's just at a social table, not to mention I sat down, would have sat down at a therapeutic table. So I think we everybody works through something through their character, whether that's, issues with their parents, issues with our siblings, the ways that we've interacted with the world that have brought us to where we are, come out through these characters. And D&D is just a microcosm of humanity. You're bringing your humanness to the table, and that's what makes good D&D, is the humanness that you bring to the table through yourself.
Mm. Yeah, for sure.
I'm curious for two things, actually. One, how many clients do you work with at a time? Like how big is the party in any given D&D game? And then I guess the second question is, if it wouldn't be too much, could you give like a hypothetical example of like a D&D scenario, like a therapeutic D&D scenario that you might use?
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
So usually I would keep for myself, like it really depends on what the therapeutic DM's comfortable with. So for me, I would try and keep the party to 3 or 4, because that way I can have focus on each client. There's always a little bit of a spotlight moment.
5 always gets wild.
Five is just a lot. 5 is a lot.
Yeah.
And I even think about like group therapy myself. I would rather do group therapy for a smaller group. And that really promotes like into the party working together. It gives time for conversation and role play. Also makes combat go by quickly. 6 people in a combat is a lot. It takes a long time.
Yeah.
It takes a long time to do, 30 seconds of anything. Let's say, for example, I've got a couple kids at a table. And one of those kids is working through, has a really hard time with impulse control. So they have a really hard time like methodically planning, going through any sort of like planned things that they like, taking steps, breaking things down into sub goals and stuff like that. So maybe they would be someone in that they'd be the kick down the door person. So they would rush up to something, or they would start with violence. They would start and like charge into combat when necessary. Like, you probably could have
Leroy Jenkins.
Absolutely. The yes, Leroy Jenkins of the party. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah,
what I would probably do in that scenario is set up situations where planning and taking time and thinking through and maybe talking through a scenario or talking through an encounter would benefit that person, the player and the party more than if they would go like strictly to like combat scenario or just to kick down the door. Offering consequences when that, if they did kick down the door, trying to set up a situation where this player gets really rewarded for the thing that is difficult for them. So we're trying and constantly, working towards an approximation of that being like a really, a good encounter that feels good for the player and the character. So that would be kind of like a really, really simple one. And then you do that within the course of like a campaign, and you track their behaviors and kind of what is difficult for them. And you talk to them about that afterwards in the debrief. But like, how was that for you to talk to that NPC or talk to that villain first before you charged in with your sword, and hearing what the player is going through and experiencing, or their character is going through and experiencing. And you can really get a sense of like, does this person kind of, is this clicking? Is this kind of moving forward for them?
That's really cool.
I think that's generally like, that's good. That's kind of good advice just generally, I think, for DMs anyway. The idea of taking, you know, giving your players scenarios in which they're going to have to not do the thing that they do. Do you know what I mean? Like giving them the ability
growth,
to
for
do.
Sure.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And promotes the branching out and giving yourself more scope and more complexity to your character and things like that. I was actually really fascinated as you were talking through that. How does the like character creation and
so good,
you know, like session zero-y type thing, how does that go after that, you know?
Yeah, and some of the kids that I work with, you know, have played D&D before, and some of them haven't. So they'll, you know, some know more than others about, you know, character creation. And session zeros for therapeutic tabletop RPGs or therapeutically applied RPGs often consist of like diagnostic interviews, or at least a sense of like what is actually, you know, we're talking to the parent if I'm working with a young person, or talking to the young person themselves about like what some of the presenting concerns that way. So that's kind of like one portion of the what I would call session zero, like an individual interview, setting up some rules and boundaries and guidelines for play and what it's like to play at a therapeutic Dungeons and Dragons table. And then also going through character creation. And, you know, I've had some young folks come in and they are the quietest, shyest person, barely say two words. And they're like, I'm going to play a bard. And I'm like, yes, let's do it. Like, let's have you be charisma of like 18. Let's have you be the face of the party. This is awesome.
It's like the one time the DM's going to let you just pick your stats. Like, yeah, you
100%.
Take
like,
that 19
you put whatever you want
charisma.
Down there. And then sometimes, yeah, you'll have like the player, you'll have players play like opposite to form, or you'll have players play like true to exactly. They're like, I want to be a barbarian. I want to kick things. And I want to kill things. And it's like, okay, cool. And then it's about adapting, you know, looking at the dynamics of the party and the players who are playing together, and trying to come up with encounters and situations where, you know, this party's working together, they're cooperating, and everyone has opportunities for growth. But yeah, a lot of people, I find people I tend to play either opposite to what they come as a person, what they come to the table with, or exactly the same. So there's there's really no middle ground.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And it provides the perfect, you know, I think no matter where you play D&D, the moment that the barbarian stops, thinks for a second and uses their words is always a great moment at a D&D table.
It's
always a beautiful moment. Yes. It's usually a few sessions, like it takes a little minute to get
there,
but we, you know, you do get there.
And the results are pretty varying, like it's pretty role dependent.
Yeah, with their low charisma, it's pretty role dependent. Yeah,
for sure. I'm also curious, how long do the campaigns normally last?
It depends. It depends on what like you've set out for, and at the outset of the like course of therapy, whether it's 8 sessions, 10 sessions, usually 8 to 10 is kind of what I'll run with generally. Yeah. Mm. And then sometimes you have players leave because of extenuating circumstances or scheduling. But generally try and like to keep the party together for that amount of time. Short little like mini campaigns.
Well, first of all, that sounds like a lot of additional like work, because I assume that you're having to write campaigns for every single one of these parties. So that's like, that's an amazing amount of work that you're putting in.
But it's a labor of love, right? Because you become like, I think it's, you know, as every DM does, you love your players and you want to see them shine. And, you know, I always like trying to remind players that like your DM is secretly out there rooting for you. They just truly are. Even if they don't show it, they're out there rooting for you. As a therapist, I always root for my clients.
The game. That's all it is. They're just trying to put stakes in the game so they make it look like they're not rooting for you, but they absolutely are just as gassed when you roll a nat 20.
100%. They're maybe gassed in a different way, but like they're stoked on it. You know, as you care for your client, as a therapist, I have so much care and you know, and compassion, and put my heart into therapy with all of my clients. So I just get to do that in a beautiful way, and we get to tell a story together, which is really awesome, which is so cool.
I feel such a like sense of pride. Like I have the halflings will probably know because I've told a few tales to the table and things about them. But like I have like the chaos group, which they were called the Dragon Boys for the longest time.
Yes.
And I remember the time when they became Dragon Boys to Men because they did something and I was like, oh, you've done it. You finally, because like none of them really knew how to play D&D going in and they finally did the, and I was like, I can't imagine how overwhelmingly amazing it must be for you to do this with young children and that like young people in that scenario, because I want to cry when my players like, you know, they use an action and a bonus action in the right way and crit on it, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
I can't imagine actually changing someone's life whilst that's happening. It must be absolutely unbelievable.
But as a DM you are changing someone's life. Like you
not
are
not in the same way, but yeah, but I yeah, absolutely. It's just an amazing experience.
And like, as I said, we could talk for hours about that, 100%.
Yeah,
we do a whole episode
on
mental health in D&D. It's so good.
Yeah,
it's so good.
That's a whole thing.
Well, I had another question, actually, about, and I think this could segue us into a larger topic, which is, how do you handle, in those games, how do you approach the topic of player death, or excuse me, not player death, but PC death or NPC death?
Mm. With reverence and care. Because death is death is hard regardless of, you know, in D&D death is hard regardless of whether it's a, an NPC and, you know, or a PC especially, but you, when it's in a therapeutic group, you have to really consider that a lot of these kids are coming in with stuff. And I mean, as everyone does, everyone comes into the table with their own preconceived notions about death and what affects them personally and how they exist in the world in relationship to death. But something, you know, we provide a lot of space for it. We talk about it, we debrief it. We honor that grief comes in waves and that you may grieve for the party will grieve, for the players will grieve, and you celebrate the life, you know, especially if the character doesn't come back. But generally characters come, I know generally in my world, characters come back, or there's a way back to them. And that's on every different DM. But we avoid introducing, if there is a new character, we avoid introducing a new character immediately. We give the party some space to breathe. We honor that character, whether that's through a funeral or a quest to go bring them back, or get their soul back. It's you know, character death doesn't exist in a vacuum. So we have to honor the fact that there are going to be ripples at the table with both the players and the characters. And that's not just at a therapeutic table. That's at like every table. So you have to, as a DM, show the impact of the death, like create meaning and purpose and draw stakes from it. There has to be some sort of narrative consequence for someone dying. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. This, I was going to say, this is a very good segue, Jeremy.
Very segue. Thank you.
Excellently done.
I bought the limited edition segue just for this.
Just for this episode. Thank you very much for doing so. It's funny, in my own experience, I feel like there needs to be like a whole thing on like, you know, like a chapter somewhere or a whole chapter about dealing with it. Because I remember it was when I first had like a PC death in my campaign, I like so wasn't ready for the emotional weight that I would feel.
Mm-hmm.
Like as the DM, I was kind of expecting that I'd be like just trying to like hold the floor and give, you know, make sure I give the player like plenty of time to like say their dues and do the thing. And I remember I felt floored by just like, because I was seeing what it meant to the party and then to the player themselves, that it was such a strange experience. I think the first time when I really wasn't expecting it, I think now I'd be able to deal with it like a little bit better. But like, I think back to it quite a lot being like, did I give the right amount of space? Because I know that I felt, I don't feel like I was prepared for it. Like, I don't feel like I was ready for that moment to happen, because I think most DMs, most games don't really tend to have PC death that often. It's very rare, unless you've really stacked a combat or you're in like the big boss fight type thing, that you do get it.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess like, what would your advice be for someone who is starting out, or maybe even wants to run like a really difficult campaign, because, you know, that's something that I know I really enjoy doing, mm-hmm. is running a difficult campaign. And if you do that, you're always riding the line of potentially having PC deaths. Mm-hmm. So what would be your advice? You know, how would you prepare, I guess, as a DM, kind of, for the potential for that, for yourself as well, because like you're attached to these characters and you Absolutely. Want them to do well, and you know
they're my babies, and yeah. you want those characters to do well. So like I don't know, after a lot of thinking and pondering, I've kind of come up with in my brain the like what I call the six pillars of death in RPGs. So there are six things that influence how folks deal with PC death at the table, even NPC death, but like we're talking like important NPCs, PCs primarily. The first thing is who died. So we have to answer the question of who died, because often what I find is that if it's an important NPC, it ripples differently than a PC, and even a villain's death impacts the table as well, depending on how that happens. And often what I find is the first death at a table often sets the tone for how death is dealt with for the rest of the campaign. I think of the first death that happened in the Blackwater campaign. So this is when it was still a home game. And there was, you know, six or seven of us sitting around my living room. And one of our monk at the time, you know, he was a man out of time. He'd been frozen in time, displaced, and his family was long gone. All of his people were long gone. And we went into this big boss fight, and he had come up to my cleric, Nepi, and said, "Nepi, if I go down, don't bring me back. I don't want to be here because my family is gone and I'm not the choice." And, you know, my sweet cleric just was like, "No, don't worry about it. Everything's going to be fine. We're going to go into this battle. Everything is going to be okay. So we go into this battle, and it's so harrowing and so hard. I think we were level 7 or 8 at the time, and we were fighting this like really powerful wizard, and he had summoned like a chaos elemental of like, it was like fire, water, earth, and air. And it was just like this giant, big elemental had come up and ripped a hole through the plains. And you know, when we managed to kill the wizard and we managed to destroy the elemental, but at the elemental's death, it exploded, and our monk was right there, and he failed a death save and then rolled a nat one on his second death save.
Oh, no.
So we had this moment where we get out of combat, and Nepi runs over to Torin, the character. Shout out to Adam for just playing this so well, who's the other player that I was playing this with. And Nepi like drops to her knees, and she's like holding the diamonds in her hand. And he's dead. He's like dead. And she's like, "You asked me not to, so I'm not going to bring you back." And so she has to deal with that choice.
That's a great story. I'm fully into this.
Yeah, wow.
This sounds like a movie, bro. Like, from the moment, it's like, "Don't bring me back."
I'll be honest, that sounded like some Jeremy Cobb shit that did. Like, that was some Jeremy Cobb DMing right there. He would do that. Yeah.
It was wild, because, like, there was six or seven of us around in my living room. We were all weeping. Tim, our DM, was weeping. Adam was crying. And then our characters had to deal with that. Like, we buried him and we had a funeral for him, and our like he was a follower of one of the gods that are another, we have two clerics in our party, and consequently they're both married, Nepi and Kokani, and Kokani is the cleric of Arathis, who's like the god of technology and civilization. And Nepi, my cleric, she's the high priestess of the goddess of the moment between life and death. So in our campaign, Raven Queen is gone. Well, not gone. There's problems with that. But like Nepi's goddess helps people transition. So she was like starting these like very elaborate burial rituals and like getting him ready. And she's like, "Oh my God, I can't do this. He doesn't follow my God." So like passing that over to our other cleric, who's having to go through his like first funeral rites.
Whoa.
So like it just rippled through our party, and then we buried him, and you know, our party's walking back down towards the city after this big battle, and you know, this group of like kids runs by and they're like, "Who are you? Like, what is your group called?" And in that moment, we took Torin's last name, which was Blackwater, as our party name.
Damn.
And yeah, so the first death at the table has ripples through the entire campaign. The entire campaign.
Jeremy is like so in love with this right now. Like, I wish everyone could see his face.
I'm just like, oh.
Well, if you want to know more about our campaign, it's all on YouTube. You can go watch it.
Yes, y'all got to go check this out.
Go check out our episodes of Chatwater where we talk about all this because this wasn't streamed. But so like, and I think about this because it's like when we think about who died. As children, we're taught that our PCs or the characters we love have plot armor. Like every Disney character, we have, that's where we learn this from. We have plot armor. And I remember for me, one of the first deaths that I really resonated with that was like, oh, this is something is different about this was Boromir in Lord of the Rings.
Oh, yeah.
So that's like one of the first PCs that you have that's like, oh my God, that character just died? Like what?
Mm-hmm. And when's Boromir coming back?
And he's just not.
Yeah, and you have it's just a flashback if you watch the extended edition. That's
exactly.
It.
Yeah. And you have to process that. So that's the first death. I mean, if we think of, you know, the Fellowship of the Ring is like the ultimate D&D party. That's the first death, and we see that ripple through the rest of the campaign.
I will actually throw out as well. You've spoken something that's just rung so true for me, which is about like how the first death sets up. Jeremy, I'm thinking about the campaign we did because the first NPC death we had was a very big one. Led one of the most like fun-loving like bard characters to just go full like rage mode and
Liam Neeson in Taken.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Literally just took off out of the room and was like, I'm finding whoever's responsible, and was just like on a warpath for like a day and ended up setting in motion like a lot of things which were going to take several sessions. And it's so funny because then one of the PCs from that group died. Maybe like 6 to 10 sessions or something later. It was around that, I think. Maybe even less. And the exact same reaction then happened with Dennis, with Jeremy's character.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
It's so funny because I really feel like, it was almost like, it's almost like set the tone. It set the kind of precedent of like the world and the world we're in. And I remember, happy, that sounds awful, but like I'm like happy that was the tone that was set, because it felt right for the setting and it felt right for the what I was trying to create. And it makes me kind of glad because I'd planned that NPC death, so I might even potentially offer that as like a bit of advice. Like, do you know what I mean? Like, if you're running a high stakes and tricky campaign, maybe giving yourself the grace of like really being able to control the scenario with like an NPC death is maybe better than having to like wing it with like a PC, which might happen in like really unceremonious circumstances. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. And death brings stakes to the table, regardless of how the death happens. Death brings stakes to the table. It reminds, as it does with us as humans, it reminds us of our mortality. It reminds us of our character's mortality. So that coming into a game, you know, really will kind of shock the players back. Like, death can't be inconsequential. You know, D&D is not great. I mean, it has so many mechanics around death and healing. Like, there's 8 or 9 different classes and subclasses that can heal. So like, what does that say about our fear of mortality, right? Like, if there's so many different types of characters that can heal, even wizards with a high enough spell, with a wish spell, you can bring someone back, right? True. So like, if you, I think there has to be, D&D's not great at their like mechanics around death. So the narrative consequence often is what plays out at the table. Sure, it's not just who died, it's how they died. Right? Because we consider the difference between like a heroic death with someone like dying in battle, or death serving a higher purpose, or a tragic death, not because it's important, but because it's inevitable, or like based on a weakness or flaw in the PC's, you know, a poor choice that led to their death. And the big thing, you know, at the table, you wish to avoid random or accidental death. You don't want to avoid pointless death at the table.
Yeah, yeah. You don't want to take falling damage and that be the end of the road. Yeah.
Exactly.
unless it's campaign one of Critical Role, where Keyleth turns into a goldfish.
The key fish moment, yes.
That was pretty great.
Yeah. something I really appreciate, and I think, you know, our DM Tim does this really well at the table, is avoiding, you know, considering what your character would die or risk their life for. And if there's a death that occurs at our table, there's generally a way back at it. There's only been one time in our campaign where, you know, Tim has killed a character outright outside of mechanics. But that's because it was essentially written into a character's backstory that there was a way to kill him, like a Chekhov's gun kind of situation. But there's a narrative piece and an extra step that is done before that, you know, bringing that character back. There's always a way back from it, whether that's, you know, healing magic, resurrection, going and, you know, getting a soul. In this case, it was the big bad at the time. And a lich had, you know, his heart was like there was a curse or something placed on Kokanee's heart. And the lich took it, teleported it out of his chest. So he was dead.
Whoa.
Yeah. But because that was the gun, the Chekhov's gun that was built into this character's backstory. But, you know, but Tim had it so that the goddess that this, you know, that Kokanee served, Arathis, essentially put him in a stasis. And then we were on a quest to go get him a new heart because there was one and we had to go get it. So we went on this big, you know, big side quest to go get him a new heart. And, you know, the player who played Kokanee, Matt, played an NPC, a different character for that couple, those couple sessions. But there should be a way back from death. Because killing people outright isn't fun. Like killing people outright for no reason isn't fun.
And I think it always feels a little like, normally I think it's very rare, unless a player wants to play a new character or, you know.
Absolutely.
So like, so for instance, in the instance where I had a PC death, the first thing I did was like, hey, look, like, do you want to bring this character back? Like, you know, we had that conversation like straight away, like what, in what scenario? And we kind of worked out something that we felt like felt appropriate and et cetera. And I think that as I was thinking about this, like building up, knowing we were just going to discuss this, I the thing I kept coming back to, and I'd love to like get your opinion on it, Emma, is like, I was like, I think what I would do is like, I would always offer a way back, but like at what cost? Do you know what I mean?
Absolutely.
I think that's like the thing that really excites me as a DM and as a player, of being like, is there potential for like the cost to the outweigh the benefit almost, you know, if there's going to be other lives at stake? Like if you're going and hunting down a lich, are you going to risk releasing that lich like on people, on towns, on, do you know what I mean? Like, are you going to go through all of this time instead of doing the thing that you need to do to like save the you know, the kingdom or the realm or, you know, things like that? And I think that's a good way, at least I feel like it feels like a good way for me to allow there to be stakes, but without lessening the enjoyment. Because I definitely think that it'd be very easy, like if Jeremy just killed my character like on a whim because of like combat, and I'd spent months like honing this thing and making it and shaping it and sculpting it, I'd probably feel really like just gutted, but not in like a fun game way. I'd just be like, oh right, they're just that's it, they're just deflated. They're just dead.
Because your agency has been taken away, right? You don't have choice anymore. So that's one of the other pillars, is like the agency and autonomy of the players to make decisions about their characters, which often works bi-directionally, I think, with the DM. So
can
like,
you list the pillars, the by the way, because I was writing them down and I was like,
so there's who died, and then we talked about that one. How did they die? And then the next one here is the agency and autonomy of the players. So like how much choice and trust is there in the game? There's also investment and immersion at the table, in-world culture of death and out-world culture of death. The agency and autonomy one is like the consequences of death need to be a conversation between the DM and the player, as you were talking about, Jasper. Like they need, like, is their story finished? Is there like, you know, and if they're not, is the path to bring them back? Like they may not be the same when they come back in some way, shape or form, you know. And some people can't deal with that in the context of fantasy escapism, which is what D&D is. And like, that's totally fine. But that needs to be a conversation ahead of time at the table because, you know, like I think the discussion of like the soul returning to the body, that has to be the player's choice, is a huge moment of consent. It's like, are you okay with this death? Is this something you're all right with? Or do you want to come back? Because if you know, even if the, say, for example, I'm in the example I provided before of where like my cleric was trying to bring back our monk, say she had tried to revivify him in that moment, you know, at the end of the day, the player, Torin's player, Adam, has the choice of whether Torin was going to come back or not. Yes. So that's the consent piece. And there has to be trust at the table that that's going to work through the way it needs to be.
And like, what, even just like, what an incredible narrative moment to then turn around to Torrin and say, Torrin, you feel your friends calling you and pulling you back in one direction, and you see your family and your loved ones ahead of
you.
Which direction do you go in? Like that, I mean, I literally just got tingles. Like, do you know what I mean? Like, that's just like, what a moment to give your player, you know, and then give the rest of the table if they then go towards their family, like, I'd be like floored by that. Do you know what I mean? I'd be like, what, no?
Or what if he comes back and then is resentful towards your character? Because he's like, I made this decision, but also I'm mad at you. You should never have put this on me.
Yeah.
And like, and the more agency and autonomy the players have about their character death, the more comfortable they are with the process. They're not necessarily, it's not necessarily an easier process, but they're more comfortable with it.
Yes.
So that's the kind of agency and investment piece.
I also think like what you're saying about agency as well, is like a lot of it for me is about like the players knowing how bad a situation they're getting themselves
into.
Do you know what I mean? Like, there has definitely been times. Take the final of Cub and the Caterpillar. Spoilers here. Just mute this for like the next 30 seconds if you haven't listened to it already. But I fully went into the final battle with the thought of like this Mooty could absolutely die here. But I was prepared for that as a player because I was like, it felt narratively like that would be a just cost. Do you know what I mean? Like, I was prepared to pay the cost of losing my character because we were doing what was right and what was fair. But we absolutely thought, I think both me and Yati thought, we are going in here and this might be it. You know what I mean? We really thought
it
this,
almost
and
was.
It almost absolutely. Was. There was a moment there it got real sketchy.
Well, the more the characters are the players are invested at the table, this kind of like investment and immersion piece, the more they care about their characters and the more, which is one of the other pillars, the more they like are invested in the relationship that the party has together. Like, I think about one of our recent Blackwater sessions. We were going into this really big battle with the Raven Queen, actually. And
just with the Raven Queen.
Just with the Raven Queen.
We've got the big battle. Just with the god. It's fine. Don't worry about
just
it. Anyway,
with a very, very begrudged, very, very angry, partially dead goddess. Yeah, that was a fun time.
That'll be fine.
Super fine. And we were like, okay, we can't kill her, so we have to banish her. And we were going to try and banish her to the negative energy plane. And we have a half-assed plan that we don't know if it's going to work, but we're going to try our best.
This is real familiar. I feel like I can relate to narrative threads everywhere.
Yeah. I think all campaigns have the same stuff running through them in some essence.
Just more the idea of going in with a really half-assed plan, being like...
To banish someone.
To banish someone really rings a bell.
Well, and there was like... So there was myself as the cleric, as Nepi, our other cleric, Kokani, and an NPC high priest who had come with us because we needed three... clerics to be able to cast like our version of power word banish is a spell in our campaign.
Very cool.
So it requires an item and it requires like it essentially drains all of your magic above third level to be able to cast it. So and you have to have at least a certain number of spell slots available, otherwise it does like 10d10 damage to you, and it's like it's nuts. So you know, my cleric had Nepi had to, you know, anchor her into the negative energy. We had to open the rift, anchor her in there. You know, Kokani was going to try and, you know, push her back into the rift, and then we had to seal the rift again. So we knew in this battle that there was something bad was going to happen. Like, somebody was going to die in this battle. When you have the, you know, former goddess of the transitionary moment between life and death, you're like, somebody's going to die in this fight.
And someone's got to get close enough to push the goddess.
Exactly.
That's a concern for me. Yeah. That'd be like, okay, I don't want to do that. I don't think any of us want to do that, because whoever's doing that, there's a strong possibility.
We didn't really have a choice because we kind of let her out by accident.
Right. Sure.
We let her out. It was a bad moment. It was an oopsie.
That was a whoopsie.
It was a whoopsie.
Was the goddess just in there? Did she just run out of the door?
Oh. We just kind of, well, it was just problems with banishment could be a subtitle of the Blackwater campaign.
We don't need to cry about, we don't need to cry over spilled goddesses.
No, certainly not. So, you know, I think about the session just before we had that fight is all of our characters were like, essentially like making wills. And we're like, okay, if we die, and we did this like as our characters. So if we die, what happens? You know, like, we have to create contingency plans for ourselves. So, like, you know, I think one of my, you know, Nepi had was like to our wizard Yana was like, you have, there is a letter on my desk in my room. That is my will. You know where it is. And if you can't get my body back.
This HeadGum podcast is brought to you by Aura Frames.
That is right.
From grandmothers to new mothers, aunts, even the friends of your life, every mom loves an Aura Frame.
Holy shit, even aunts?
Yes, especially aunts.
Oh, wow.
Because it was named the best digital photo frame by Wirecutter and selected as one of Oprah's favorite things. I mean, these Aura Frames are guaranteed to bring joy to moms of all ages.
I believe it.
You have an Aura Frame, don't you?
Yes, I actually more than believe it. I know it. I've got one for my mom, my mother-in-law, my grandmother-in-law.
And dare I say, your aunt?
And dare you say, my aunt and my aunt-in-law. Everyone's got one. Everyone loves them.
I mean, Mother's Day is right around the corner, and there's no better gift than a digital photo frame. You give them the frame. It's got preloaded pictures in there. And you know what? You can update it with an app. So every time you take a new picture of a sweet little person or place or thing in your life, it gets automatically sent to that frame.
Exactly.
And right now, Aura has a great deal for Mother's Day. Listeners can save on the perfect gift by visiting AuraFrames.com to get $30 off plus free shipping on their best-selling frame. Holy smokes.
Excellent deal.
Yeah, that's AuraFrames.com. You use the code HeadGum at checkout to save.
HeadGum. Nice.
Yes. HeadGum. It's easy to set up. It's loved by everybody, including Oprah, including your aunt.
Mm-hmm.
So do check them out. That's AuraFrames.com. Use code HeadGum at checkout to save.
Damn right.
And terms and conditions apply, of course.
Of course.
Thanks again to Aura.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective, unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
It's okay, because I was like, if I get sucked into the negative energy plane, I'm not coming back. So we have to be okay with that. And so I think that the higher the immersion and the investment in the characters, as well as how long the campaign has been running, because how long your campaign has been running, you get much longer attached. If you've only played two sessions with this character, you're going to be less invested in their death than if you've played, well, I think Blackwater, I've played 140 sessions as Nepi.
Yeah, that's going to sting. That's going to really
and
sting.
She hasn't died yet. She's the only character at the table who hasn't died yet.
Oh, that's amazing. Yeah.
The high priestess,
going.
The high priestess of the goddess between life and the goddess of the moment between life and death, only one who hasn't died at the table. Thank you so much.
Amazing.
But, and then, you know, like, I think that also ties in is what you were saying, Jasper, about the DM culture. Death at the table, which is kind of like the in-world culture of death piece, because there's the DM culture, which is like some DMs institute different rules about death. Like sometimes there's permadeath is the only option. Rolling death saves secretly is another one I've seen. There's a limited number of lives, rituals around resurrections and revivification. Some DMs are also just out for the TPK. So like that needs to be communicated to the players before you play. And if the players consent to that, great. Awesome. Love that. Love, love, love that. But there has, and there's also like, I even think about the expectations of the game itself. Like you have modules like Tomb of Annihilation or Curse of Strahd, where you're like, someone's going to die. It's just someone's going to die. And we have to be okay with that. And so people, the PCs become to, or the players come to expect death more readily than other modules.
In settings and modules and things like that. And I think like, if I was to do like a gothic horror noir setting, I would be like, look, people are going to, do you know what I mean? Like that, this is a part of the setting itself. It fundamentally won't work as a setting probably if you're all covered in plot armor and keep getting, you know what I mean? Or like, at least if you're not coming back in some slightly horrific way, right?
Yeah.
Just because that's
speaking
what the setting,
which,
you know, calls for. Yeah.
In fact, I think that was what even kicked off you, Emma, mentioning to me that you might want to be, to talk about this topic, was specifically when it was prompted by the guy gothic horror noir campaign that I've been running, where there's been more developments, but I've been talking about that on the show, where one of the characters had died twice in like within 3 in-game weeks, and his family was just like, all right, bro, we had enough of this. They sent him away, and he had to bring in a new character who then died within, I think, 2 or 3 sessions.
Oh my goodness.
Okay, actually, this is I think we should get some advice from Emma on this one. When you have a player, because I want to point out as well, this player is also the PC death that happened in my campaign that I just spoke about. It's the same dude. So when you have a player that has a particular propensity for dying in campaigns,
he's bringing in his third character.
Wow.
So he's 2 characters in my campaign with no other PC deaths. What, 3 deaths in your campaign, Jeremy?
Yeah. Like, although I will say the third one at least was pretty much unavoidable. Basically, I'll give a very, very short version, but he there was a vampire that was like one-on-one with him.
Oh,
and
no.
I basically was telling him, just from a narration standpoint, I was like, oh yeah, she's going to like alter your memory using this device that she has, so that you remember something different. And he's like, nah, man, let me roll for it. And I was like, I don't think that's a good idea. And he's like, let me try and resist it. And I don't think he realized that him resisting it, and she could read minds, meant that she would know that he had resisted it, which meant that he knew that she was trying to wipe his memory, meant that he couldn't be allowed to leave.
Oh,
and
no.
So he was like, well, here's the worst part. At the end of it, he's like, man, that was rough. Okay, well, you know, when the agency brings me back, and I was like, oh, about that, you were just assigned to this case, and she's a suspect. And if you abruptly die shortly after investigating her, that's not going to look good. So you're a vampire spawn now, is the long and short of it.
Wow.
So he has since been brought back completely under her control.
Yeah. I think that's a very adequate consequence for death.
Yes. Yes, absolutely.
I think that's, at the end of the day, there has to be, you know, like we talk about narrative consequences for death. You know, the story changes, the PCs are affected, the world is affected in some way, shape, or form by this death. But even mechanically, I think that like adding in stuff around death to make it more like stats crunchy could even be, you know, like in Blackwater, depending on how long you've been dead, you come back with certain levels of exhaustion that take a long time to get rid of. So, you know, there's nothing, you know, killing a character in D&D is you can come back with all your stats, you look the same, and you have all your stuff. But there's nothing, I was joking with, I think Tim and Sean about this, who's another player at our table. He's currently DMing our the campaign that we've got going right now while Tim and I are on maternity leave, is nothing affects a player more than when you fuck with their stuff. Like when you mess with their stuff or how
that
they look.
Perfect build.
Build. Yeah. So you can, there is ways to like mechanically or crunchily change stuff as a consequence to death, but I would say do so sparingly with care as well, because the player will have a difficult time with that likely.
And hey, if you want a really easy version, you've got like things like the Reborn, you know, all of that UA stuff that just came out. That's a very simple way.
Well, it's not UA, it's official now.
It's official.
Van Richten's Guide. And we actually did that with the very first PC death. They were brought back as a Reborn.
Yeah,
very cool.
That one feels a little less, as a player, your species or race stat, like race abilities, are like secondary to your class ones. So I feel like that's, for like a first death, that's probably not too painful in terms of the crunchy removing of a bit. Like you do get some cool stuff in return being a Reborn. So like it's not like you're losing you're not losing like a whole bunch. So I feel
and
like
they
that
made
could
that
be a
choice, really. It was like basically because it costs money to bring somebody back and they are not that rich, rather than trying to go to somebody powerful and go, I think, risk reincarnation or something like that.
Ugh.
They decided to have like somebody basically Frankenstein bring them back.
Yes.
And that's how they ended up as a Reborn. But the other thing I wanted to say is something that I've instituted I think I mentioned it on Blackwater, is that because it became clear that like, oh, death is going to potentially be very frequent, I kind of made the rule that everybody gets one, where like you could die and then be brought back and it's not going to have like lasting effects necessarily on you, even though like what you have seen in the great beyond might be quite disturbing. But on repeated deaths, you start to gain like permanent like your personality will start to change because like what you're seeing, it's essentially giving you PTSD from what, like the horrors that you're seeing in the Shadowfell and all this stuff.
It's like Cthulhu mechanics almost, like,
And so, over time, your mental health starts to deteriorate if you keep dying and getting brought back.
Absolutely. Mm. And I think that that ties in really well to, like, there's like, when you talk about the in-world culture of death, there's like the DM culture about how the DM deals with death at the table. And there's also like the narrative culture, like what is the in-world lore about death? Like, how is death treated in your game by the, you know, various religions or the, you know, what is it? How do different races, backgrounds, classes deal with death? Are there clerics involved? How so? How much of an influence do the gods have on death? Like in at Blackwater, something I love about the campaign is that the gods are really close. In our game, like we have the two clerics in our party are like the high priest and high priestess respectively of their religions. So like there is a lot of talking to gods that happens a lot of the time. And not only that, like my grave cleric is like her religion deals with death. That's just what they do. So we talk about death a lot. And if the more you talk about death, the closer it is, the closer, you know, that lore is about it, the more your party is kind of steeped in it. Not in a bad way, just that they're dealing with it on, a level that is more tangible than some parties who may not have that kind of tie to.
Yeah.
To death otherwise. And then finally, I think the last thing that really ties into death at the table is the outworld culture of death. So we're talking about the players now, and it's like, because cultural and cultural views and personal beliefs about death influence how we deal with death in RPGs. You know, our own views of death can even conflict with our characters, which can create like an uncomfy feeling of like dissonance, that kind of cognitive dissonance, because grief is understood in a cultural context. Different folks deal with grief differently.
Very differently.
So, and it's so fascinating. Something that I just love is the fact that the emotions and the things that we experience in a D&D game are an approximation of things that we've felt in the quote unquote real world, but our brains can't tell the difference. The emotion that you feel, like the sadness that I felt when the mother superior of, you know, my character's order of priestesses was killed, that was real grief. Like there is a video of me crying my eyes out on the internet to prove that I am like, that's just me like fully grieving in that moment. So our brains can't tell the difference when we're that invested.
I always bang on about this, but there's a really cool, like, scientifically worked out when studying the like signals in the brain that like where your imagination is and your memories are exactly the same place in your brain.
Absolutely.
So literally when you remember stuff that happened in D&D, your brain it's exactly the same as when you remember stuff in real life. I think that's so fucking beautiful. Like, I really love that. It's so awesome. Because then effectively what would happen is if an alien was to come down and probe my brain, then Lamora Canthus would 100% be a real person who lived and died. And do you know what I mean? Like, that's so, that's baller. That's really cool.
And then to like stack on top of that, if you feel safe at your table, if there is like a culture of emotional safety at your table, big feelings come through so much more saliently because you feel comfortable to feel vulnerable in front of these wonderful people that you play with and your DM, and you can be in character about the death.
And what a gorgeous thing that is, because I think quite often you don't even have that in real life. Like, how many people can say that about like their family? You know, like, it's kind of sad, but like, I don't know if I could kind of sit and openly grieve and weep over a death in front of like some of my family members. Do you know what I mean? But now, because of D&D, I'd happily do it in front of some of my friends because I know that they hold me and support me in that moment and give me that space. And do you know what I mean? So I feel like what an amazing thing to actually be able to do, you know, because actually think for a lot of people, you don't have that kind of support
safety.
Or that kind of safety in real life. It's hard to come by because it's a scary thing, I think, because there's a way of you, with it being, again, going back to what we first talked about, with it being slightly removed, it gives you that freedom to kind of, like, ease yourself into it. It's like you're kind of lowering yourself into the pool as opposed to, like, jumping in it when, if it's something real life, it can feel like that, you know, it can feel very like it's just like a what? Like, it's so unexpected. Whereas, like you said, like getting to build the narrative, understand the culture of death, understand everything around it, understand the scenario that you're in and the players, it's like you get to just lower yourself in, and it's such a cathartic and shared experience that I
absolutely
think is so amazing.
Something that's boggled my mind too is you know, we've so Blackwater started as a home game. We started playing on, you know, New Year's Eve 2017, 2018 as a fun one shot. And then we all loved it so much that we were like, again, more please. So we just started doing that. And, you know, when the pandemic hit, we realized we had to start playing online because we couldn't play in person. And then we were just like, we should put this on the internet. We should put this on the internet. Let's put it on the internet. So we were up streaming on Twitch with like no preparation. And I am constantly shocked at the community that's built up around us, the like beautiful, wonderful gravel verse that has grown up around us. We call our fans the Gravel Boys because they're named after some of the Petch that are in our campaign. They're like rock goblins. They're great. we love our Gravel Boys so much. But the like we've gone through some big, big character death moments on stream and to have our community there with us, supporting us, and also like feeling those feels right alongside us is magical.
Cause we think we get attached. Like fans can really, I mean, boy, it's like, that one's a tough one because that one's that's a whole different
relationships. Ain't no joke.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that's because, you know, not only do we see ourselves in the characters that we play, but the, you know, the folks who, the joy, you know, the watching the other characters play, you're like, oh, I see part of myself in there. And then when that character dies or something happens to that character, you're like, oh my gosh, no.
Ooh, I have a story about this. Dish. I have a story about this from the, I think it's from the 80s, because I think this is when this happened. So the second Robin, Jason Todd, famously died. He was killed by the Joker. And there was, at the time, he had not been very, very popular, like in comparison to Dick Grayson. A lot of people had kind of hated Jason Todd. Mm-hmm. And so the DC execs or the editors were like, all right, cool. Let's give the potential for him dying. Let's offer that potential, but then we'll have the fans vote on it. And so it was like the tiniest of margins. It was a really like it was I think it was less than 1,000 votes.
Wow.
In favor of death. Like the margin was less than 1,000. It was, I think, like possibly even less than 100. And forevermore, the writer said every time I think it was sometime after that, some old guy, he walks into a place and introduced himself. And the guy's like, hey, and it's the guy that killed Robin. And like all these people got really angry at him and were like yelling at him in the streets because it made the news. Like it was in the newspapers. Wow. It was like, Robin is dead. And like the country's like, what? How have they done? Why? How did they do this? People who have never read a comic, like who only ever like watched the Batman series in the 80s or the 60s are just like, what is wrong with you? How could you do this? And it just shows that it shows like on a cultural level, how much death can impact people who feel that they have a relationship to those characters.
Ripples. It's those ripples. They ripple in as characters. They ripple out to the players, which ripples out to the table, which ripples out to the, if there's an outworld community that watches or engages with the game in some way, shape or form.
Oh, I have a question actually.
That's
a point that I wanted to underline and then a question, which is I think one of the things that we've brought up a number of times that I just want to highlight again is it's very important if you are the DM to speak with your players ahead of time before instituting any sort of specific death mechanics or anything like that. Like for instance, the PTSD sort of mechanic that I was talking about, I talked with all of the players about ahead of time to be like, yo, are y'all cool with this? And like, they could have said no, and we just wouldn't have done it. On that note, Emma, what do you think about when players and DMs conspire to have their character killed without telling the rest of the party?
Ooh.
Because I've heard of this happening.
Yes, I have too. And I think that it can be a very appealing option, I think, as a player, if you want to play a different character. I think what I would advise against is be careful about trying to force meaning at the table, because if it's forced, it'll feel forced, because when D&D happens, you know, when that storytelling, when you're in flow, when you're jiving with your character, when you're jiving with the other players and everything is firing on all cylinders, there's like stages of group dynamics, and there's like forming, storming, norming, performing. Which is like the four stages of group development. When you're in that performing realm and you try and force something, you move backwards. Everyone feels it. It doesn't feel right. It doesn't jive with everything at the table because it's not organic. So I would say just be careful about it and try not force a moment to be made. Mm-hmm. There's likely another way to have meaning. And if you really want your character, if you really don't want to play that character anymore, maybe death isn't the way out. Maybe you could, you know, maybe they retire. Maybe they go on a different quest. Maybe they're pulled in a different direction. They don't necessarily have to die for them leaving to be important. That's what I would suggest.
And I would also like to throw out here as a potential caution as well. It's like, do not underestimate how much other people in the party might like that character and love that character. And to the lengths they will go to ensure that character doesn't die.
Because unless you're going to try and get them back.
Exactly. Unless your DM is going to super railroad that moment, I know for a fact I, as a player, would be combing through if like a player just died, do you know what I mean? Like something happened and they just straight up died. I would be coming through every mechanic in the every book. I'd be going through homebrew stuff just to see if there was any possible way I could save them. And like, let me tell you, I'm gonna find a way. Like, so like, do you know what I mean? As like a DM and a player, like you've got to be ready for that. You've got to be ready that in the moment, like this big grand thing is gonna happen, and then the cleric should be like, no, I cast Revivify. They're fine. Like, do you know what I mean? Like, that's going to happen. And then the DM are going to be like, but
and even,
no.
I even think of moments without death when the character's like when the character wants to leave. I think there was a moment in Blackwater where one of our warlock, Finnan, who is Adam's character, who he played after Torin, was like, I don't know if I can be with the party anymore, because we'd had this big dilemma come up. There was a Duergar who might have seen something, and we were like discussing the moral ethics of killing him. And it was like, it was huge. It's now referred to as the Duergar dilemma. It's one of like the biggest moments in our campaign around death, of course. But you know, like he was like, I don't know. He was on one side of the decision and a couple of the party members were on the other side. He's like, I don't know if I can be with the party anymore. And we weren't sure if that was like what was going on with Finn. And so we like scaled a full scale intervention. We're like, we care about you. We're your family. You got to be here. Like, this is important. You can't just wander off and martyr. Like, you can't just go like it. So I think that there are lengths that these, you know, the players and the characters will go to maintain the party, because the party doesn't feel whole if one person is missing. There's always going to be a space, and that's whether that space comes from a party member leaving or a party member dying. You have to honor the space, however that comes to be. Because if you don't, it just feels false. It feels wrong. Because that player's absence has ripples.
Yeah. I'm very conscious of the time, and I honestly feel like I could talk to you forever, Emma. This is such an amazing conversation. I'm really loving it. But I have one last little question before we do a tale from the table, which is just, I'm very interested to know about the tone, because you said you touched on the culture of death within a game. Yeah. And I'm interested just like in terms of like, you know, when you... is it driven by the players? Can it be driven by the DM when it comes to like how death is treated of just like random NPCs? Do you know what I mean? Like just, and like monsters and or like real world creatures. And cause you know, at the beginning you often will fight like a bear, you know what I mean? Yep. Like if you're level one, you might fight a bear or something. And I'm just interested, or you might just fight like guards, nameless guards, right?
Yes. And nameless guard 1 through 7. Yes.
Exactly. and I'm kind of curious, how do you ride the line? Because it's always fun to do the, you know, there's always like a moment, I feel like in most campaigns where, you know, you'll suddenly see Guard 6's wife and child crying later the day. Yes. Or, do you know what I mean? Like there's always...
His name was Alexander.
Yeah, exactly. And then they suddenly, you know, you set up like a trust fund for Alexander. It's a whole part of the campaign. But like, I'm just wondering where the level is for you in that. Does that come out of a conversation with the players? Is that come out of a... is that something that you as a DM might be like, this is the setting? Like, so this is the way we treat death here. And this is... Murder is very, very... common or it's just, it doesn't happen? Like, yeah, how does that work for you?
I think it's both. I think it comes out of like, when you start the, you know, when you start the campaign, talk to your players about what the cult, like the culture of death is, what is like, you know, in our, as I was saying, in our campaign, you know, with Nepi being part of the party, she has some very staunch views about what death is like what death is supposed to be like. So that has obviously permeated into the party. But that's also a conversation that happens with the DM. Like, you know, when I wanted to play a grave cleric, I'm just using this as an example, but like I wanted to play a grave cleric and Tim was like, cool, what's your religion like? So I just craft, like, you know, Tim as the DM gave me free rein to craft what Nepenthe's entire religion was like. So I was like, awesome, great. So I've, you know, built this entire religious history of this, you know, how death works. And I think it's a blend between what the players do with the with how they approach death and what the DM has set the lore or the narrative around death. Because if, you know, if you've got a party where death is kind of like, whatever, we kill anything we want to and nothing really stands in our path. Like, does the DM have some consequences for that? Or do the gods notice? Do they get noticed by local authority? Like what is the lore in game about it? And then I think it's a co-creation between how the players respond to that. It's bidirectional. I think it goes back and forth. Like, how does the DM respond? Then how do the players respond? And you've got to work together on it. And then I think what happens then is the longer you play that campaign, the longer you sit with those characters, they begin to start creating their own rules about death. So like I was talking about the Duergar dilemma, that was nothing to do with Tim. That was nothing to do with the DM. That was entirely party created. That was a party created problem that we needed to solve. So because we as a party now have our own, you know, rules or views on death. So what starts as a conversation between the DM and the party will then essentially move to sit on the shoulders of the party, and the DM can kind of just sit back and let them deal with the consequences of what happens. Yeah,
for sure. I definitely bring it up because I know, Jeremy, we had that was a whole thing for us when we started Wagadu, because the culture of death and like killing like animals very specifically like is very very different to core D&D, and I remember it being like that was like a, you know, that was a real like ride or die, like learn the consequences the hard way moment for for us. So I do think that is a very fascinating thing, and I hadn't really considered the consequences of what that might look like in a game before. The idea of playing a D&D game where death had such, you know, like even the smallest of most innocent deaths could have such grave consequences. In that we killed a fish and it resulted in Muti's hands and arms and teeth being taken away from him. Like, do you know what I mean? So like, it was really amazing, kind of experiencing. Like, right, how do we now negotiate this world? Because my D&D language up till now is fireball helps party survive. You know what I mean?
Fireball cures everything.
I think Muti cast fireball one time after that. Like, literally. it was a
partially on himself.
And exactly, sent it on himself.
I remember that episode. I remember listening to that episode.
Yeah, exactly. It's definitely a whole thing.
I even think about, like, in our campaign, we had a necromancer. So we have the, you know, the high priestess of the goddess of the moment between life and death, who is like, no undead, never. That is bad. And then you also have a necromancer in the party. So that's something that had to be worked out. But, it, you know, death has affected our campaign so much that our wizard now is like, I don't know if necromancy is for me anymore. So, she's moving subclasses. Like, they're now Tim and Jen, who plays Yana, are, you know, creating their own subclass of, we're calling it an ether wizard. So she's like touched into like the life force and the drive of everything in the universe.
Whoa, that's very cool.
And really she can see the threads of connection between everything and manipulate them. So that's kind of how her necromancy has changed based on the way that death has affected her in the campaign.
Wow. I feel like I had to give some sort of nod to the, I feel like I have to mention my apparent now affiliation with necromancy and necromancers.
All the fun spells are necromancy.
Jeremy, people tag me and stuff now. Like, someone on Instagram found some, like, cute stickers that were, like a necromancer's kit. They were, like, cute stickers with, like, a little dead hand and, like, but they were really, like, these cute. And someone tagged me, like, we need to get these for Jasper. I was like, oh, no.
That's amazing.
This has really become a thing.
This is your new thing.
Puts the fun back in funeral, am I right?
Yes. Yes.
Jasper
that's
Cartwright
amazing.
Puts the fun back in funeral. Jeez, that's bad. That's a bad tagline.
Jasper Casket Right.
That's good.
I'm changing it. I'm changing that on Twitter right now.
But actually, one last thing was on the subject of Wagadu, that in the very finale episode of this first season, Death ended up becoming an ended up becoming an unexpectedly big part of that episode. I don't know if you've listened to it, Emma, so I will.
I have. Go.
Okay, you have.
I'm caught up. Of course I'm caught up.
Yes. My favorite guest. The immediate whiplash of going into that episode when we started that episode where Jasper and Unatu are both like, yeah, it's going to be fine.
And then immediately
it's like, okay, so let's find out who died. And they're both like, oh.
What?
Yeah.
Oh, no.
I love that.
Yeah. Yeah. And let's roll for it. And what you do will have a direct impact on how well they might roll. The way you plan for this battle will depend on how well they rolled. And it's suddenly, as two people, I guess it was like Muti Nonganagama realized what it was to be like a war general, you know, in that moment. Mm-hmm. And suddenly we looked around and went, like, this was all because of a decision that we made. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think that the reason then they ended up becoming so hell bent on fixing stuff and like fully taking time out, you know what I mean, from like their own lives to fix it was because they were like, this can't have all been for nothing. We can't just leave this now and for it to be for nothing, because this was like, it was masterfully done by Jeremy, but that was heartbreaking. I was absolutely crushed after that episode. I was just, because it really did, I was suddenly like, the weight of, it's one thing to be in a battle where maybe three or four people, like NPCs or something, end up getting killed or whatever, but generally you've done something, you know, if you're fighting a lich and you have like some guards that came with you and those guards get vaporized, you kind of go, well, look, we stopped the lich, you know what I mean? So ultimately, we've probably done
priorities
something,
here,
you know what I mean? Yeah, Jasper the Lich is probably going to end up being called. We realize that there are priorities in that scenario, whereas this one was like, I got to the end. I was like, I really hope we did the right thing. Like, this is,
yes.
Could we, like, and I was suddenly like, could we have done this differently? Like, could we have avoided full scale? Like, and I think this is probably a great way to bring this kind of conversation like full circle. It's such a great way to give your players that moment of consequences and meaning and shared feeling, because it just suddenly meant so much more that we were like, we are entirely responsible for every single one of these deaths.
Yep.
On both sides.
Yep.
Do you know what I mean? And there's only one that there's only one we wanted. You know what I mean? There was only one person that we actually needed to get rid of.
You're speaking my language right now.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it was just it was... it was a real heavy moment. It was a real heavy moment.
And even the way you talk about it as if it happened 10 minutes ago.
Oh, yeah. It's
right?
Like
it sits right there and it'll always be that close, because that's the emotion that's tied to it. That's how
I'm very excited to see what kind of Muti we meet in season two, because I don't know how that's going to have affected him. You know, him as a Daima has a very close relationship to death. That's the whole religion. Again, you know, Odessa is the goddess of death, and it's seen as in a lot of Daima culture, it's seen as a good thing, you know. But Muti didn't feel like that was a good thing, you know, in that moment, and that was like, and that changed world's views for Muti in that moment. Like, I feel like
Muti and Nepi need to sit down and have a conversation about how they deal with death.
Oh my god, what a crossover.
I would love
meet in a tavern one shot of Muti and Nepi
in a multiverse tavern sitting and talking about death.
We gotta get Andrew to come and run, what is it, the Inn at the Edge of Greenwood with all of the different characters showing up.
Oh my
just hanging out and talking about their experiences death.
Such anytime, a wonderful anytime.
Concept. Anytime. I love it.
Yeah. And as a little teaser, taster, the upcoming season, which we're recording now, death is, I would say, a prominent theme
of
that season as well.
Oh, my word. We are,
can't wait.
We are currently four, I will give you this, we are four episodes in to recording, and I have feared for my character's life every single episode, multiple times in the episode.
I think D&D should feel deadly.
Things
it doesn't necessarily
hard.
Have to be deadly, but it should feel deadly.
Yes.
Oh, this is this is just straight up deadly.
It's just deadly.
There's no way.
Love
this
it.
This is like we were like there was a moment in the last one we were like that could have if she'd have just rolled differently that was just it. What? 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 Run! that was not fun. That was not fun. That was not fun. Oh, man. Emma, please take us home in this episode. Please, if you could, we always ask our guests to offer up a tale from the table. It can be anything, any wild moment that sticks in your mind. It can be an emotional, sad thing. It could be an amazing, empowering thing. It could be something that's just so wildly silly that is stuck in your brain, but anything you'd like, please share it with us and our audience.
Okay, so we were that lich that I was talking about before. So he was trying to, this happened very early in our streamed game, so there is it on the internet and you can go watch it, watch it unfold. Mm-hmm. So we were really trying hard to, you know, he was trying to rip open a tear from the abyss and bring Thara's Dune back. That was his big, big push. Very bad.
That's bad.
Very, very bad.
I mean,
bad.
Lich
and
is already
like,
bad. Thara's Dune.
A packed lich of Thara's Dune. So it was my, you know, Nepi's goal was to stop this. That was her prophecy. That was like her whole thing was to go do this. So we go to this, you know, old city called Bacall, and we realized we were outnumbered and outgunned. So one of the biggest moments, I think, in our campaign that is currently still having ripples is we contacted the Raven Queen because she had beef with Thara's Dune, because Thara's Dune ordered to have her killed. And this was like in a war that had between the gods that had happened thousands of years ago. So Nepi had a moment with the Raven Queen where she's like communing with her. And the Raven Queen was like, I will help you, but you all owe me fealty. One thing that I will call you for. And I thought about it for a moment and Nepi said yes. And it had huge ripple effects within the party. The party was furious with her. It affected her relationship with her husband. It was like, it was nuts. So we go to the city where we're going to fight this lich. And just before we get out into like the main courtyard square, we hear like the sky goes black and we hear this cacophonous sound of ravens pelting down from the sky and just massacring everything. Like the thralls and the cultists, and there were some giants that were helping us. They died too. And so massacred, just absolutely massacred. And so we ended up fighting this lich. And when that was happening, so Nepenthe's husband, Kokani, his dad was like a top henchman of this packed lich, and he ended up killing his dad, which was so theatrical and amazing. And in the last moment we had to go seal the rift, so Nepi was gonna have to banish Thara's Dune, was like clawing his way through. And Nepi was like, okay, I have to do this right now. So she's standing at the edge of the rift. Our wizard was dead, our paladin had the choice to like was right there. And so Nepi shoves her gun, because in our world clerics use guns, or the only class that can use guns because they're holy weapons, because they're charged with shards of gods anyway. So she puts her gun in her Kokani's hand, she says goodbye, and she steps into the rift. So she steps into the abyss. She banishes Thara's Dune, manages to chain him down. And then the abyss starts closing. The rift starts closing. So our paladin in that moment had to choose go into the rift to save, you know, Callie, our paladin, had to go into the rift to save Nepi or go revivify our wizard. So she made the right choice and she went to go revivify Yana, the wizard. So then in the last turn before the rift closes, our other wizard, Letters, who's a war wizard, So Nepi's in the abyss. She's like getting pulled further and further away. Letters casts Bigby's hand in the abyss.
Whoa.
And backhand Snappy out of the rift. So you had to roll for it to see if, like, roll an Arcana check to see if his, like, spell could work. And I had to, like, choose to fail the strength save. And I remember Tim asking me, do you choose to fail the strength? I was like, yes, of course I choose to fail the strength.
No, I
so
resist.
So Nepi got backhanded through the rift, caught by our war wizard, and the rift closed. And we are still dealing with the ramifications of what happened with the Raven Queen. Needless to say, she's pissed. So we're still dealing with that. And that's my wild story of getting backhanded out of the abyss.
Listen, Emma, we are big fans of a good backhand on this show, as you know.
Necessary
backhands are always good. Lou Wilson, the child, Lou Wilson with the OG backhands in the
one of my favorite moves ever.
Still, multiple times. Still so funny. Wow. Listen, if that was not a good enough trailer to go listen to Blackwater D&D, then I don't know what is, because I got gassed and chills about that. So
thank
I'm
you
like,
so much.
Okay, we got to go check out some Blackwater D&D, and I'm going to urge all the halflings to do the same.
Thank you.
So where can we find Blackwater D&D? Where can we find you and all of your amazing work? Please plug the hell out of yourself right now.
Well, thanks. I first want to say this has been just such a treat. Thank you so much for having me on. We'll come back anytime.
Yes.
So yeah, I'm Emma Carlson. You can find me on Twitter at EMM_Carlson. I'm also on there at Blackwater D&D, which is our Twitter handle. We're also on Instagram as Blackwater D&D. So you can find us on Twitch Saturday nights at 8 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. All of our backlog is on YouTube. Everything is there. We're running a mini campaign right now, which is set in the actual, like, what happens after this town of Bacall was completely wiped out. So we're kind of seeing the ramifications. It's called the Dresda Files. Please go watch it, and please go watch all the back stuff on YouTube. We're there every Saturday night. So yeah, that's me, and that's my show. I love it very much.
Absolutely amazing. Thank you so much. This has been such an amazing conversation. I feel
what
like
a treat.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, and like just such a smattering of amazing little tit stories from tables, and just so good. We're definitely going to have to get you back on. I think we may have already had maybe a little idea about something we're going to do for a future ep. We are definitely going to do that, because that's going to be a whole lot of fun. But thank you so much for joining us. This has been incredible. If you are just finding us and just listening to us for like the first time, you can find more of us on the social medias at TB Halflings. You can also head over to our Patreon, which is patreon.com/TB Halflings, where we have a bunch of extra goodies if you enjoyed this. I think that's about everything. And I would like to say thank you once again to Emma. Please check out Blackwater D&D. And we will see you very, very soon. So long, Shire folks.
So long, Shire folk.
That was a HeadGum Podcast.